8, 6, 1, 0.
Welcome to the Radio Art Hour, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Oh, radio, radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Created specifically for terrestrial AM/FM broadcast, whether it be by commercial, public, community, or independent transmission. Come on a journey with us as radio artists explore broadcast radio space through poetic resuscitations and playful celebrations, subversions of the complex relationship between senders and receivers in this hour of radio about radio. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the Radio Art Hour and Wavefarm's Radio Art Archives.
I'm Tom Rowe at the Wave Farm in New York, and today on the Radio Art Hour, we're going to hear The Stranger, a radio play with musical accompaniment by Sun Ra and his orchestra for the Mind's Eye Theater on Pacifica Radio from about 1968. The date is a little unsure. Jess Spear will also introduce Sheila Davies Sumner's What is the Matter with Amy Glennon? But first, let's hear The Stranger on the Radio Art Hour.
Hello, this is Raymond, your friendly neighborhood host. You may remember me from the old days of radio. If you do, don't admit it. It only dates you, man. We want to turn you on. Hear this tale of terror set in a boarding house. That creepy-looking building right down your own street. Haven't you wondered what goes on there? Listen. As Ridiculous Productions presents The Stranger.
O'clock, dinner's late. Puts me in an awful state. I work all day. A guy deserves a meal on time to ease his nerves. As friendly as a Kit Kat. Not one for conversation. Can't imagine what he's doing in this boarding house, unless he just moved in. I'll swear I raised the hair on the back of my neck. I feel like a watchdog scenting danger. Oh, about good evening, Mr. Bois. Did you notice the stranger?
Yes, I saw him. Indeed, I did. He scared me. As if something evil had padded across the carpet. premonitions are passé, but I believe in them. He is a storm cloud. Before the rain. Or, if I may strain your ears with the cliche, Mr. Orville, he's an ill wind, one that will do us no good.
Ill wind, you make me smile. Although he had a most unfortunate smell and he wore a coat of a very odd style. Well, that's no reason for you to become a weather prophet. Still, there's something about it that makes me dread the prospect of having him around. It's bad enough to be crowded by people that you know. If he moves in, I think I'll go. I must sit down. I'm beginning to sway. Been under a strain. Made a big deal today. And how is the publishing business? I hear the price of paper is going up.
The price of paper doesn't matter at Leaning Tower Press. You see, we make our own. Yes, we have a man who creates it for us in his garage. Oh, it is lovely and homespun and silky to the touch.
You say this sort of process doesn't cost you very much?
Our man spends all his days sorting rags and sifting sawdust. He sends his products to us at a ridiculously low price. This is for art, he insists. For art. Really, he looks beautiful in our limited editions. I will show you a copy of our latest as soon as it comes off the press. Rupert Wichett's amazing new novel. Shock! We won't sell many copies. But I assure you it will make a tremendous splash among the Canescenti.
And at the Leaning Tower, you're very certain the Canescenti is plenty?
Mr. Gonzalez, I hadn't noticed your arrival. Back from the tenement, stemming the tide of misery for the Department of Welfare? Oh, the grief. I'd say it was like dropping an endless string of packages into a bottomless shopping bag. You will never fill broken lives with such expedient stuffing.
We can only administrate the laws. So we do our best. Mrs. Abercrombie had her fifth baby last week, a boy. Born at Bellevue. I'm afraid their present allowance will not be enough. You know, Mr. Abercrombie is a chronic alcoholic. He hasn't worked for 11 months.
Oh, dear, the world is full of ne'er-do-wells. People are unsteady. I'm going to find out why dinner isn't ready.
What a warrior.
A warrior?
All his gears are caking. He'll have ulcers in several years. I admit no sympathy with the garden variety businessman, though he is the type I try to understand.
It's easy to type, Mr. Orville, but at this minute in our house there is a man who I've failed to fathom. When I passed him on the stairs, his features engraved themselves vividly, as if some strange ciphers in my memory. He walked crouched over, hiding, shielding something. Have you seen him?
You must be dreaming. No soul like that lives here.
My nightmares are never so real. He's upstairs, I'm certain.
Guess what I heard as I passed through the hall? Muffled bumping noises. A crunch and thud as if objects were being dragged across the floor. Somewhere near Mr. Orville's door. Is he moving?
We talked to him a moment past. He didn't mention that
intention.
Do we ever know the ways of others in this tenement? Each person marks his separate time. In one small room, his day is spent.
As a matter of fact, Elisa, we were discussing a new lodger who seems to have moved upstairs today.
I can't understand where Mrs. Fenwick will put him, unless she's found a new magic formula for increasing space. How do we know the man intends to live here? What if he's a murderer? Or a thief who has escaped from an insane asylum?
You are over-anxious. He carried a bag. Maybe he came to fix the radiator. Or, and I'm not to imply anything, but possibly He's an exterminator?
It's nearly summer. The radiators are never used.
Maybe he's the plumber.
Perhaps Mrs. Fenwick is having my window fixed. It won't open. And I love to lean out now it's warmer. Today I saw summer like a stain of sunshine through the air. It has dissolved into the garden, where cosmos petals absorb it, flushing pink with pleasure. Oh, the sky has the clarity of an essay by Aristotle. It is in conversation with the trees.
Elisa, sometimes you scare me.
Is it so unusual to look at the sky? To paint, I must use that cup of blue like a teacup on my table. And a tree should be as familiar as the door of my house. I should know the light over it, the texture under it, and not have too much pride to tip a hat to the spirit inside.
A tree has no spirit. At least I'm not aware of one when I am near it. People have spirits. They must be helped. We should involve ourselves with their needs. To recreate our world in art is like taking the temperature of a sick man because we enjoy watching the little red markers. When the need is to care for those whose pain is immediate, vital, possessing their senses like a formless shell in which they are caught. If you know children with no food to eat, everything else can be only retreat.
The world is mostly made up of citizens attending to their own troubles. Pedestrians you pass on the street are busily taking care of themselves, yet they do their life's work with willing hands.
They should do more.
More?
How can they pass without a thought to heal another's pain, heedless? They must do more.
But I do. I do.
Painting? Painting all day? Alone, I can show you a million cases. Starving. Are you heartless?
If you'd look at my work and the work of other artists, you couldn't say we're heartless. Art can gather the pain, the beauty, charging them with the electric power to penetrate the senses, so the unseeable reality is seen. A track is cleared through the debris to the central fire. I can feel the desolation of Guernica because Picasso painted it.
The desolation of Guernica. My supervisor will slay me if I do not have my reports written today. After dinner, I'm going to finish them off. They're packed away in my desk like golden eggs, ready to hatch into good deeds. Each one is more important to my client than a room full of pretty pictures. It's the very food that keeps him alive.
I have to finish these pictures tonight for the agency. The freedom of a freelance artist is endless. One works on one's own time. All the time, I fear. Fleeing, always fleeing, with a deadline stalking near. I can earn enough to pay for food and rent, my only intent. The rest of my energy I use for painting. There are many essences that must form themselves upon my canvas. I would never deny them.
Is that your new picture?
A pattern from the city at night. The rhythm is swift, like a train in passing. The theme is a flash of a neon light that swings back and forth to the winds caressing, repeating its movement like birds in flight. The colors are sharp. They are made to glare, but they fade into black, like a trumpet's blare, into a silence. The texture is soot. Harsh dust and smoke have wrapped themselves into every stroke. When I see this city, I don't approve. Yet it is a pattern that I love.
Once, this was a city of new houses, with clean bricks, polished wood, and shiny plaster. But time passes over like an endless earthquake, and we must build out of these ruins the image of our survival.
Each painting is an image, caught out of eternity. It is worth more to me than money. Mr. Orville, are you moving? Or having your room repaired? I thought I heard quite a commotion from your vicinity.
Impossible. I'm not moving. As for repairs, that's absurd. The house could fall in jagged decay before Mrs. Fenwick lifted a finger to plaster a single crack in the wall.
But there seems to be a great deal of activity overhead.
Young girls. Always imagine the fantastic. Come, don't bother me. What a day I've had. You can't believe. My nerves are in a terrible tangle. I've studied the market from every angle. The boys at the office say I'm getting old, forgetting how to be daring and bold. But I know perfectly well we cannot stand a deficit.
The entire stock must be sold. You can play with ideas, you can order gimcracks and gimmicks, then you'll find you are bankrupt. Kaput.
It's dangerous to be wrong these days. Gimcracks and gimmicks my foot. Once in a while, some items are natural. It'll sell. It goes like a whiz. Public can't keep away from it. Good for the biz. Then it's worth taking a chance. But as for me, give me a good old standby. Then you know where you're at. Gimcracks and gimmicks my foot. I got it figured. Manufacture more of these. Sell an average amount. That's your standard item, which is best to count. I'll gamble on that. With success, make a fortune. If not, we still have a company. Then, as a touch of genius, I propose a gradual increase of those.
Mr. Oh, you're making me dizzy. How can you be so horribly busy?
I tell you, my nerves are in a tangle. I've studied this market from every angle. The trouble is plain. By their own admission, we're dealing with cutthroat competition.
Mr. Oh, you move me to tears. How do you stand it all these years?
My dear, I have a philosophy. And I act only when I see the deals I make. Oh, profit me. And you can bet, by luck and push, I've added a lot to my salary. My goodness, I'm beginning to feel quite ill. I forgot to take my vitamin pill. However, a man in my position has got to be clever. You can't sell the public the same old stuff forever. My stack has perfected a new machine that will beat our competitors. Wipe them clean. I don't like to say this, but I think I can trust you.
Of course.
Go on.
I have the plans upstairs in my room for a last-minute checkup. Tomorrow they'll be patented. Then I've got some of the smartest businessmen in town to invest big money. But there's nothing to dare. You'll all make profits if you bought a share or two.
Mr. O, I admire you, but investments are something I can't afford if I'm going to pay for my room and board. I don't gamble on profits, but on paintings. I did these pictures today. One has congealed into life like a good pudding. The others are dead. I shall throw them away.
Still, it is important that a picture, or even Mr. Orville's new project, is coming to life. Sometimes it is worthwhile to gamble on new projects.
Worth it, but hard to gamble on new projects. The Leaning Tower Press has often been in danger of toppling in ruins. This year, we published 4 books. One, I believe, is great. But the sentences all run together in a plethora of meanings that ricochet upon each other. So hardly anyone will read it, except the college professors and the friends of the authors who realize that he has released many conceptions they've never succeeded in expressing. Since some of the passages are turned obscene, a few hundred copies will be sold to those who pride themselves on reading the sinful. Still, it's published. It will live.
Yet, we are trying. Our work goes on.
If you care to see it, I brought the manuscript home to revise tonight. But frankly, I'm afraid to carry it around. To me, it's more precious than rubies or pearls.
Marvelous. Next time you go dancing, we'll drape you in manuscripts. And you can wear 2 perfect sonnets for earrings.
Everyone has something he prizes most highly. You may say it's only a whim, but who knows how value goes in this world?
Your value is simple. One has it appraised by competent men. Then one invests it wisely. so the price may be raised.
If you're so wise, Mr. Orville, why leave your precious plans upstairs with that strange man in the house?
I go up right now and make sure everything's safe. You come too, Mr. Gonzalez.
Mr. O's plans don't concern me. I prefer not to know where he put them. Then I won't be responsible if they're gone.
Are you afraid?
Certainly not. What's there to fear?
Dinner's almost ready. I'm afraid we'll be late.
Excellent thought, Mr. Bois.
It's true. Mrs. Fenwick is always complaining about serving cold meals to stragglers.
Besides, I'm so tired with the day's work. I'm glad to rest before dinner.
Whether we like it or not, the atmosphere around here is not at all restful.
Let us discover, if we can, what is the meaning of this man? Clouds passing swiftly over may bring storms that wash our hopes away.
Well, the family has gathered. Sorry to be late. I had to wait ages shopping at the grocery. But it was worth it. Roast chicken tonight, my friends.
Onward to the dining room.
I'm famished. Went to lunch with an author at a tea room where they serve nothing but salads.
Funny there's no place set for the new lodger. If the man's moved in, he should be eating with him.
No one's found out if there's a new lodger as yet.
Why spend our time spinning suspicions about shadows? If it weren't for that miserable crashing upstairs...
It might be your room he's crashing in.
He looked dangerous.
He crept on the hall like a wounded mouse.
Though, if he is a new boarder, it wouldn't be an order to disturb him.
It is quite possible that he is one of my authors. Come on a visit. If he lost his way, it would be out of place to insult him to his face.
Recently, I read of a man who had no home, so he stole into other people's rooms to rest. It would not surprise me if someone such as he would be hanging around the neighborhood.
Unfortunately, I can't credit that story. But I have heard of a madman who would wait for girls in their rooms, stab or strangle them before they could scream, walk out as calm as you please, leaving the floor all red and gory like the wake of some vulture or praying bird.
Mr. Orville! My dear, that's absurd. But I know a man who's possessed by the idea of blackmail. He spies at doors to discover where people hide their letters. Then he grabs and reads them voraciously, as if to satisfy an inner want in him. If there's any scandalous information, he sells it back to the owner at an adequate price. His eyes are shifty as crawling lice. But otherwise, he seems quite nice.
Nice?
Talk about nice. A burglar once had the theory that old women like to keep close to their family jewelry as to their last memory of a younger life. To profit by this quirk in his victim, he investigated her actions from waking to sleeping, and he would manage a collision in the street where he pilfered her keys as he helped her up. With the thoroughness of an expert, he ransacked her home and escaped with the jewels in his coat pocket.
Fascinating tale. But not plausible.
Nothing is plausible unless you see it happen.
Reality is like a stranger who carries with him threat of danger. We can say he isn't there, though we meet him on the stair. We can say he is a friend, though he cheat us in the end. Or imagine him uncouth, yet not dare to seek the truth.
It does no good to play with visions. We must understand and make decisions.
It's always more amusing to imagine the worst. For anything else, it seemed like heaven. Look, there's no need to scan the stars with a telescope, as somebody's already told us about the hunter and the bear.
They never sit bills. Mrs. Fenwick, can you explain why the new lodger's not eating with us tonight?
Another lodger? In our house? That would be a sight.
The man upstairs.
The man? You're seeing things, Mr. Gonzalez.
Perhaps it's the exterminator.
No bugs in this building. Of all the nerve.
Our repairman.
And a Ford repair.
Who was that creature on the stairs?
Haven't you heard the noises?
Don't talk in riddles. You'll have me chasing ghosts soon. I'm going upstairs to find out if you're all mad.
Maybe that was a bad way to tell her.
Well, when it's tough enough turning to our private rooms, should we be responsible for the whole house? Why question the disturbance in the hall?
We're always content to rest and chat and play with the shadow like a cat plays with a mouse.
Our only hard reality is what troubles you and me.
But now we see more facets to this diamond life than our chipping.
Rabbi! Call the police! While you were discussing that stranger, he's been through our rooms and escaped like greased lightning. He even took my hearing aid.
Oh, Lord, I thought she'd been raped.
This is frightening.
Friends, your most precious possessions are gone. He's stolen your treasures one by one.
What's he taking?
I'm not sure yet.
I'm lost. He's run off of my plans, I bet.
Fellow did a thorough job. He even got some of Elise's pictures.
My pictures?
And my manuscript.
My papers.
My plans.
Not likely he'd miss them. He's a crafty one, that one. Snuck out by the kitchen.
My chicken is gone!
Oh!
Why did we wait till after we ate to catch the scoundrel?
It can't be too late.
Now get the police. Sound an alarm.
I'll phone the detective.
Won't do any harm.
My plans must be found.
Tonight there's no peace.
Robbery!
Shambles!
Call the police.
Tonight, there'll be no peace.
Mother of God, what a calamity.
Someone should call the police.
Land sakes, what a disgrace.
I suppose you were to judge us isn't safe.
Where did he go? Did anybody see?
I can't believe this has happened to me.
What a shambles, everything's lost.
Think of my business, think of the cause.
What a crisis, what a calamity.
I will wish I knew who's to blame.
Who was that scoundrel? What was his name?
The stranger.
The stranger.
Stranger.
Watch for the stranger. Put your life in danger. Stranger. Stranger. Jack Ripper rides kittens up the end. Not into fart. Watch for the danger. Stranger. Oh, he'll put your life in danger. Stranger.
Written by Maxine Haller. Directed by Jack Marks. Music by Sun Ra. Sound effects by Morris Markowitz. Costumes by Olenka. Audio by Fred Friedman. Featuring Virgil Catherine Doyle, Raymond Espino, Jack Marks, and Maxine Haller. Your host, Raymond, for The Stranger.
I'm Jess Speer with the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive, and I'm delighted to present What is the Matter in Amy Glennon by poet, sound, and radio artist Sheila Davies Sumner. Deeply philosophical, the piece is filled with rapid-fire confetti blasts of references to mythology, science, metaphysics, philosophers, theorists, artists, and subconscious symbolism, playfully hurrying the listener on in an engaging, almost giddy pace toward the center of human and universal thought and experience. In its many transmutations, twists, and turns, the piece encourages the listener to reflect on storytelling, identity, the relationship between science and philosophy, and the very nature of being in both the physical and metaphysical senses. Let's hear it now.
She was born on a night when the moon was seen twice before the sun rose.
The Kamsen wind blew bright plumaged birds in through the window. Her head was an eclipse, a red sun, a red dome ring, a rose-gold crown, but she entered the world feet first. She laughed and she listened. Because a sprinkling of marble dust made it shine, the smile in her face was inhuman, and she grew up questioning the legend of her own species.
It's a black, blacker than black night in the luminiferous ether of the prairie, where the girls are cleaner because of the dust. There's a sickle moon in front of me just rising again to its sea legs, and over my head are the giants and the dwarves and Hercules counting teeth in the mouth of the dog star, and under my bare feet is the center of the flat, flat earth.
Oh, Columbus!
Oh, Columbus, I've lost my way, tapping in the black-soaked mazes of the dark with only my thought experiments to guide me. Everything thinks, all of nature and ideas and machines. They speak or they sing, and I listen. I am who I am, and who I am not. I brood myself into thought, I brood thought into warmth, and I am alive in my own mind, experimenting with comets of insight and paradox and mummified logic, and my golden germ brooding until sparks ignite in the supreme solution of thought.
Let your body do the walking.
Yes, my body has followed me here. It seems to go everywhere I do, but it must be a phantom. My body doesn't remain the same, it doesn't change with time, and it isn't in motion. I think, therefore, I am not a body. I mean, I know I must have a body, but I seem to lack a physical interpretation. I mean, what I mean to say is, I think my body has been de-souled.
Let your body do the walking.
I don't want to walk. I walk enough in my thoughts, and sometimes they walk in me. There's one thought, though. It's almost an idea. There's a voice inside of the idea that seems to endure fire. But I can only hear it. I can't see it. I don't know what it is.
Humanity, some say, doesn't know what it is. Neither ruler of ice nor fire. An animal with reason who has learned to walk. A god with desire who has learned to walk.
I can't, because I don't have one, because I lost it to the great old fathers of science. I let them split my mind from my body. I don't really remember how they made the split, or why I let them do it. I must have misunderstood them, or they misunderstood me, or I suppose maybe I could have just misunderstood myself. Amy Glennon is misunderstood.
Start the bidding at misunderstood. What do I hear? Garbled up front, perverted at the back wall, distorted the lady in red, unvalued the lady in yellow, unwept in the red, unwept, unwept. Text.
Amy Glennon is unwept.
Is that how you wanted to read? Elaborate, please. Tears in the aisle, salt water the lady in red, substance the gentleman by the post, matter the lady in red. Further bid, text.
Amy Glennon is matter.
Or should it read? Text.
Matter is Amy Glennon.
Which one is it? Any advance? Why will it be is standing at the back? Why will it be any advance? Yes? How could it? The man on the right when does it against the wall. What is there on the left? Any advance? What is there? Any more? All right, first sentence. Text.
What is the matter in Amy Glennon?
Very good, then. Let's explode the word matter. Matter as in dynamic geometry, the gentleman in front, as in quantum wave, the lady in front, as in external world, the gentleman, internal soul, the lady, gold, the gentleman, silver, the lady, lead, the gentleman, arsenic, the lady, bitterness, the gentleman, matter as in bitterness, yes, down it goes at bitterness. Text.
The matter in Amy Glennon is bitterness. She has spent her life staring at other people in their private cages of bone and has therefore neglected her own flesh. Behind Amy Glennon is the sign of the sickle moon. Before her is the ticket window, aglow under mercury vapor street lamps. In one hand, she carries a suitcase. In the other, a small harpoon.
Mm-hmm.
Be going somewhere. I've got this harpoon and a suitcase. And let's see, I've got my gyroscope, my idea tubes, my Geiger counter, my pocket gramophone, and my compass.
Little superluminal chameleons.
And yes, my jar of lizards. I can't forget my jar of lizards, my favorite creatures, because they grow new parts of themselves, and they shed their tails into my legs and their skins into my feet that are walking. I'm moving into the idea through its compacted layers of solid ice beneath its sheer, crushed masses of rock toward its molten interior. This idea never sleeps. It dreams, but doesn't sleep, and I can hear it talk. I can't see anything.
She was born after the moon had risen twice, and before the sun had risen once. The arch-heretic magician appeared, twirling his subjacent consciousness like a prayer wheeler. The black star sapphire eyes threw a shadow across her own face, but she entered the world feet first. She listened and she slept. Some say, whatever has been hidden and is then exposed, this is a human act. Some say, to have memories inside of love, but neither before nor after life, is the truly human realm. And some say there is no such thing as humanity, that humanity is something men have stolen from animals and plants and weather, from the universe and the atoms.
The universe and atoms? The universe and atoms. The universe and the atoms. Of course, yes, I remember now. I used to live in quantum. I did have a body that was intimately joined to the constancy of the speed of light. And when I was 3 years old, I used to play with atoms and the void.
Particles and waves, particles and waves, particles and waves.
Yes, and then I experimented with particles and waves. And when I was 6 years old, I dug up some large numbers made of ice. There were just a handful of memories preserved in the ice. Large, cold numbers. Oh, number beauty and rapture, number calisthenics. The exercise of number beauty had me aligned to the great old fathers of science themselves. I lifted the edges of their cloaks, I turned their pockets out, and there they were, as real as algebra. Stuck on them I was, in a swoon. Schoolgirl crush.
American passion.
They said we never lose our need for more numbers. Numbers are the new articles of faith. They said, let us bless you. Let us delight you with our numbers. Let us turn your body into an equation. So they blinded my thoughts in sheer rapture and stole my body right out of quantum. The things they could do because their times were mechanical. And in the name of progress and number beauty and good stage magic, that's how the great old fathers of science settled the Western world.
Blood on the saddle, blood on the ground, great big gobs of blood all around. Hey, 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 pity the cowboy, bloody and red, the old cowpony done stepped on his head.
I think the mind is in the feet as often as it's in the head. I entered the world feet first, each foot a fable, each foot winged in curious search for the perfect steps of narrative. I know that every human foot needs a set of steps to walk, but I don't know what size or combination. I don't know what the code is. To me, it's a mystery of dimension.
These dimensions are open for bidding. A 2-inch rise and a 15-inch tread to the blonde man. Will you go 3-14, sir? Yes. A 3-inch rise and a 14-inch tread to the dark-haired woman. A 12-inch rise and a 5-inch tread to the blonde man. A 4-inch rise and a 13-inch tread to the dark-haired woman. A 7-inch rise and a 10-inch tread. New bidder there. A 7-inch rise and a 10-inch tread going once, twice. Perfect. At 7:10, text.
In a classical pose, Amy Glennon contemplates a black rock staircase with steps perfect for her feet at a 7-inch rise and a 10-inch tread. It spirals up into the night sky and down into the core of the earth. Her bitterness gathers in back of her.
Do I hear in front of her? Yes, I do. In front, at the back, behind, right there, and back, and the back, to the side, and the center, and back, and the front, and front, and the back, and front, and front. Down it goes. In front. Text.
Her bitterness gathers in front of her. As Amy descends the staircase into it and is swallowed alive in its thick, dark chill, she realizes for the first time that the opposite of bitterness must be water. Oh, the great old fathers of science and me, we were so in love. We took baths together, we swam in the seas and rivers, we drank water, we froze in heated and vaporized water. Together we were making a story from reanimated morning dew and spring rain. The story was an elixir, a legend, a rhapsody, a song that the great fathers gave me initiation to sing, and we rehearsed the number again and again, cleansing and rinsing its air-colored content. I perfected the melody with such a slow fix of glamour that the story became a string of pearls around my neck and long beaded gloves and clothes of marble dust, and I became the brightest star in the great white way. In the great white way. I was so in love. I didn't even notice that the fathers were changing the words to the story in such a way that I would drown in the watery draws of all the great themes we had nurtured together. My voice was heard everywhere, and my practices as a radio star grew, embracing the cylinder and diamond disc, round-headed sapphire needles, records pressed in amber and black wax, floral horns and fiddle phones. Distance always lends enchantment.
We live in a story of gloom and of glory. The universe isn't a static affair. We came from a fireball and fell through the stars to the earth's blue salt water.
Symbols are nonsense. Everything is surface, earth, fire, and the rest. All is determined, equated, and known.
But look at the prairie, the mountains, and canyons. Earth took 4 billion years to make some dirt. And gravity is not a force, but a curvature in space-time.
Her name is Amy. She's unpredictable, weird, but mechanical. She is a finite American girl.
What is the matter with me? I am finite.
You have no beginning or middle or end.
My heart is finite and swelling beyond its size inside of my bones.
Into a soul that they peel away. Science can steal a drama the way bleach takes color. Because the fathers need the heat of passion to split the mind from the body, there's no other way. I call it piracy. They call it the one divided. They call it fission. They call it the passion of their genius. But genius isn't separation. It isn't the one divided. The fathers have misunderstood the whole idea. It's really coagulation, coalescence, the many in one, when sometimes your whole body wanders in a single particle of your mind, and other times your mind moves fast like waves through your body. Genius is forethought. It's the second thought. It's a kind of inspiration. It's an ancient air that everyone has forgotten how to do.
Be brave enough to be a genius. Look ahead, see far beyond your own time. Then look back. Be brave enough to be a genius. And this act, and this act, and this act will vindicate our species.
Now they say the story of the species is, you're born, you discover, you appropriate. That nature is dead, the world is a clock, and you can kick the dog like a dog-like demon machine.
They're fun, they're history, they're America, fun, they're history.
No, they're really not. Wait. You've got to stop. They're not. They're a hoax and a rumor. They're gossip. They're figments and fate spinners. No, they're the oracle mongers of our time, who would soon destroy in the name of what they call indivisible liberty.
Banner yet wave, banner yet wave, banner, banner, banner. banner yet wave.
They add the story like debt. So if we listen to them, if we watch them do it, our own time will spin us into theft and betrayal and disintegration. Blisters and heat, vehement fires, garnet fever, infection and putrefaction. A flood of red and yellow flames unleashed from the jaws of some kind of an apocalypse.
Very good. Let's mystify the word apocalypse. The four horses of the apocalypse, war, famine, pestilence, death right here. The dragon of the apocalypse with 7 heads and 10 horns over there. The apocalypse of the beyond called the fire of Gehenna on the isle. The three angels of the apocalypse right here. Now, can we dissect this phenomenon, the three angels of the apocalypse? Yes, Ophidim, the boy near the post, Seraphim, the girl next to him, Cherubim, the boy near the post. Now, young man, you have cherubim. Will you apply all three to the phenomenon? Yes, once, twice, three times applied. Text.
Suddenly, Amy's in the thick of an insight that comes on her like the Ophidim, Seraphim, and Cherubim of the Apocalypse. My whole story is hidden in the bitter matter. The story is a creature coiled around my lungs, who devours itself from the tail upwards until its entire body has been swallowed into its own scaling head.
Shall we psychify the creature? Let's throw the tongue in this one. Uroboros right here, salamander over there, winged dragon against you, madam. Will you go wingless? Wingless dragon for the ladies, celestial pterodactyl on the phone, womb like giant serpent on the floor, a sea dragon with a human torso and horned head on the phone, a fabulous primordial serpent with a putrefying sea anemone mouth growing on its back, absolutely bid. Any more? Any more? Text.
A fabulous primordial serpent with a putrefying sea anemone mouth growing on its back awakens as Amy descends the last black stair at the deepest center of the earth. The serpent rears up from its bed of molten iron and lashes its tail around Amy's bare feet. "Consider this," says the serpent. "Bitterness seldom comes from an unhappy fate. It arises in people who fight themselves."
The serpent is quoting from someone. Who do I hear? Do I hear Freud? Yes, Sigmund Freud is standing at the back, Mary Louise von Franz in the front, Annie Easton beside me, Amelia Earhart absentee bid, Henry Miller on the aisle, Andre Bertrand at the back, Juna Barnes at the side, C.G. Jung in the center, C.G. Jung, C.G. Jung, has the quote. Now, what is the source of Amy's bitterness? Shame in the center, remorse of the young man here, a cosmic violation at the back, a melancholic nature of the young man here, loneliness at the back, self-knowledge I do see now in the center. Any more? Self-knowledge. In time. Text.
"Self-knowledge is a bitter experience in the beginning," continues the serpent, "because everything you are, you must make your own. Therefore, stare at yourself as you are staring at me. Practice the divine bitter art. Make the hidden visible, and only then will you understand the whole work." Pressing downwards into the idea, something pulls me like a magnet. I can't see anything but the light of pure darkness, stones of liquid, liquid penetrating liquid. I can't see the shape of the idea all around me, but it feels like a vessel clouded black at the glass. This must be the nucleus. I must be inside the golden germ of my own brooding, where thought is fire alone.
She was born on a long night, when the stars had gradually overtaken and surpassed the sun. The young Archistrate Gabriel came forward now and held her in his arms. Such was the nimbus of her birth. She entered the world feet first, two rose-cut and pear-shaped gold soles seeded with streaks of pearls. She laughed and she sang, this world is not ours. Some say one is not born human, but becomes so. Some say to become human, one must grow more and more indefinite through time. That humanness occurs only at random, between the possible and the actual, between imagination and experience.
Radical moisture in the brain pan. This arcane voice is really alive. Who does it belong to? I mean, is he the youngest place of me, or am I the oldest place of him? I mean, he's the solution of something. Maybe he's a lover of wisdom, and if that's true, then maybe he knows the story of our own time, but he doesn't tell it. He listens to it. He gives it a fragrance of immortality because nature has kept it preserved in him, her liquid and malleable pre-existent idea.
It's a bright astral blue, and it rides like a stallion, and it rides like a stallion.
He's a horse with no rider, who's got order in his chaos and the play of quantum, who always knows nothing when he observes the familiar, and who is full of the most profound doubt.
Evolution is a billion-year detour. Evolution is a billion-year detour. Evolution is a billion-year detour, 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 detour. Oops!
Of course, it's the legend of the species that humanity too will pass, and he's the sad voice of philosophy, 2,000 years lost, who has his mind in his soul in his heart in his mind. He's the idea of what a human is, no one really knows, the idea that inspires you to produce a body now before there's no time left to do it. Salt the tail of the idea with fire, inflame the bitterness of your idea's throat, and taste with the taste bitter things. Brew this substance into heat, not so hot that the story evaporates, but just the temperature of fresh horse dung, and cook it in the golden germ of the idea until it's volatile. Real bitterness finds a spirit through vapor, a heart through anguish, a glowing flesh through the rigor of cold, a mind through finality, and a principle through the bitterest root. Real bitterness is a kind of self-heating that cooks its stained and perfumed grace into an original human form. And just when there are sparks of breath, when there is a subtle quickening, then move into the body. My head a rose-gold crown, my feet seated with streaks of pearls. With you, my idea, I have made this body. You have entered my ear and opened my tomb. And with this body, I have made the hidden visible, which is the practice of the divine bitter art. And that is the whole work as I understand it. You have understood the art perfectly, acknowledges the serpent to Amy. But now you must realize the final mystery, my daughter, and lie down close to my body and rejuvenate me with your new glistening human form. I didn't know you had a body. I thought you were the voice of my idea. I mean, it's... Wait a second. I seem to be falling. I seem to have fallen through. I seem to have run into myself, becoming myself, rejoins Amy, staring in fixed amazement at the writhing creature before her as it tightens its tail around her feet and opens wide both of its putrefacted mouths. With vigor, Amy raises her small harpoon, aims rightly, and shoots the serpent in the heart of its gullet. A spume of fiery, lung-driven, radical water spews forth, and a viscous black mass oozes through a fissure in the side of its ancient bulk. And as the serpent corrosively expires, out climbs Amy's bridegroom, the genuine man of philosophy, twirling his subjacent consciousness like a prayer wheel. Still clutching her jar of lizards, Amy turns and runs up the sharp stone stairs, her philosophical bridegroom following quickly in her footsteps. As she reaches the top of the staircase, a perfect circle in the open air, Amy enters the world feet first. Behind her is the sickle moon, seen twice before the rising of the luminiferous morning sun. Above her are bright plumaged birds aloft in the warm wind. As the inheritance of 1,000 centuries falls away over her shoulder, Amy slowly turns to philosophy, who comes forward now and holds her in his arms.
Now, it seems that her bridegroom is holding some kind of object. What is it? The fiery red sulfur, the lady on my left, the philosopher's stone, this gentleman on my right, the seven-petaled flower, the man there, a vessel of quicksilver right here, a cup of coffee, the woman in the center. A cup of coffee? Is that your bid? All right, a cup of coffee. Just in time. Shall we make it plural? Yes, two cups of coffee. That's wonderful. Now, what sort of cups are they? Canopic jars. Thank you, sir. Styrofoam cups, you, madam. Paper cups, my bidder. Styrofoam, you, madam. Paper, my bidder. Styrofoam, yes, madam. Paper cups, my bidder. Text.
Amy's bridegroom is holding two paper cups of coffee, as if they are the ends of a divining rod. They raise their paper cups and drink down the divine bitter water of Amy Glennon's wisdom.
Excellent. What am I bid for this magnificent postmodern alchemical opus, the story of Amy Glennon who faces the dark grind of herself and thereby transmutes her bitterness into wisdom, who unites her matter and her mind, and who redeems her human soul from the body of a putrefying serpent, all toward the fruitful marriage of pure science and mythological philosophy? What am I bid for this entire text? Start the bidding at $400,000. 400 is 500, 600, 700 right here. 800,000 over there. 900,000 against you. Will you go 1 million? $1 million in the front row. $2 million over there. 3 million Aristotle at the back. 4 million Roger Bacon to the side. 55 million. The Cartesian fathers. Yes, I'd be delighted to take your bid. 65 million Copernicus. 75 Paracelsus. $100 million Sir Isaac Newton there. 300 million the Swiss alchemists here. 500 the Greek philosophers. 700 the father of relativity. 750 the fathers of chaos. 850 the quantum fathers. $1 billion for the Cartesian fathers. $1 billion is now the bid. 2 billion the quantum fathers. 3 billion the Cartesian fathers. 4 quantum, 5 Cartesian. Any more? Any more? Yes! New bidder there in the center aisle. $5,120,000,004 going once, twice, three times, sold to the young woman holding the jar of lizards.
Amy Lovey, where are you? Amy Lovey, where are you? Amy Lovey, where are you? Get your gloves and say your knowledge.
In the light of early morning, I awaken in my berth, and I feel myself electropulsed in the confidence of creation, and in the wings of my own story, I go running with an apple in each hand.
We just heard What is the Matter in Amy Glennon, a 1989 piece by Sheila Davies Sumner, and winner of the Prix Futura Special Commendation for Experimental Radio. For more information about the artist, this piece, and radio art, please visit the Radio Art Archive at wavefarm.org.
That was the Radio Art Hour, mostly put together from the work of Wave Farm Radio Art Fellows. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the radio art you heard featured on the Radio Art Hour.
Zero, zero, and eight, and ten. Zero, and eight, and ten. Two, nine, zero, zero, six. Two, nine, zero, zero, six. Eight, two, eight, six, zero. 8, 2, 8, 7, 0, 9, 8, 6, 8, 0.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.